probably within the next 2 to 3 years, we'll get probably the majority of all the permits that we'll need.
The massive Donlin gold mine near Bethel is moving through the permitting process on its way to state and federal approval. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new research could help scientists develop an early warning system for earthquakes.
That's one thing exciting about seismology, and also a little scary, is that what happened in the past will very likely happen in the future.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The U.S. Interior Department today announced the first construction projects to prepare for oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The department says it will spend $4 million on 6 projects, most of them in Koktovik, a community within the so-called 1002 area. That's the coastal part of the refuge that Congress opened to oil exploration last year over the objections of environmental groups and their allies. The Koktovik projects include an aviation fuel storage facility, a garage, and bear-proof storage building. Some of the money is slated for 2 cabins far from the 1002 area. A new one in Arctic Village, the department says, will support field operations and an addition to an existing cabin at Galbraith Lake. Galbraith Lake is on the Dalton Highway just outside the refuge. A recently released memo says Alaska fell short in training election workers for the 2016 elections and in providing adequate staffing of bilingual poll workers in areas where additional language assistance for Alaska Native voters is required. State election officials dispute some of the findings, but say they also continue to make improvements. Division of Elections Director Josie Banky says the state is in compliance with a federal court order that sets out terms for providing language assistance for Alaska Native voters with limited English proficiency. The memo, dated in March, was released this week by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. It was written by an Alaska Advisory Committee to the Commission. Advisory Committee Chair Natalie Landreth did not return phone messages seeking comment. Donlin Gold is advancing through the permitting process for its proposed mine in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Donlin would be one of the biggest gold mines in the world. Right now, the company has 2 state permits in hand, but they say they need at least 100 federal and state permits before they can begin mining. And that takes time. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports in Bethel.
Residents of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have heard about the Donlin Gold Mine. They've seen the logo on hats and bags and on flyers throughout Bethel and villages. But it's not easy to understand the actual process to get this complex project approved. The environmental impact statement in particular, with its thousands of pages, is a difficult read.
That document is, you know, massive. I've got a degree of biologist, and I struggled a lot trying to sort through that document.
David Cannon has worked for the Kuskokwim River Watershed Council as a fish biologist, and he's worked for the Forest Service and with the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. He's also a local activist who is trying to educate the region on what he sees as the dangers of the gold mine. Donlin has held multiple hearings in villages and Bethel about the mine since it was first conceived in the late 1990s. And in an area where there hasn't been any sort of massive extraction industry, the terms might as well be a whole new language.
I knew that most people here had never even heard of NEPA, that National Environmental Policy Act, or Environmental Impact Statement.
The environmental impact statement is just the first step in the process. The EIS is required for projects that involve federal agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers and could significantly impact the environment. A broad range of state and federal agencies and villages directly affected by the mine participated in the EIS process. That's important because Donlin has to receive at least 100 permits from federal and state entities. For instance, because the mine would be housed in wetlands, the Army Corps has to issue a permit. And states are required by federal law, like the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, to regulate environmental impacts. Donlin spokesman Kurt Parkin says while the company anticipates getting most of the major permits out of the way this year, The rest will take more time.
Probably within the next 2 to 3 years, we'll get probably the majority of all the permits that we'll need.
The EIS is probably the most bureaucratic endeavor in the process. It takes years and millions of dollars to complete. It's been 5 years since Donlin submitted an application in 2012, but now that the final EIS is out, the company has a much clearer idea of its progress. It already has 2 permits from the state, with the most recent one allowing wastewater discharge into Crooked Creek. Compared to other proposed mines in Alaska, like the Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay, for instance, Donlin is farthest along in the process.
Donlin would probably be the largest that's nearing the end of its permitting process.
Faith Martineau is executive director for the permitting office at the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. In that role, she coordinates with federal and state agencies and industries about the permitting process to make sure information can be found in one place. Donlin is one of her projects. Now that the company is in the permitting process, she says it's highly unlikely that the state will prevent the company from building the mine.
So I would say that it's a fairly uncommon occurrence, because one of the major facets of the regulatory process is kind of this back and forth.
Throughout the EIS process, Donlin and the agencies involved calculate the environmental risks from the mine. For instance, as Army Corps drafted the report, stakeholders gave feedback and studies provided more information on the proposed mine. As a result, the company has modified the proposal in response to concerns from the state throughout the process. Donlin's Parkin says the company is aiming for approval.
And so everything we've been doing up to this point is working towards yes.
Donlin is now waiting on the combined record of decision from the Army Corps and the Bureau of Land Management, which would determine how plans for the current mine proceed. But even once the companies have all the permits in hand, they would be years away from starting construction because they would need to reevaluate whether or not the mine makes financial sense. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
There may be a way to predict some earthquakes. A University of Alaska Fairbanks researcher has discovered unusual precursor activity along the Minto Fault west of Fairbanks. UAF Associate Professor of Geophysics Carl Tape says seismometers in the region recorded minor shaking before an earthquake.
A low building up process that becomes an earthquake.
Tape says that type of warning signal has never been detected anywhere else in the world. Tape says the motion and another type of pre-quake movement were picked up on 2 occasions prior to moderate earthquakes.
3.5 and 4, which are these events would be felt by lots of people in Fairbanks. And yet we have to remind ourselves in 1995, you know, there's a magnitude 6 on this fault zone.
Tape cautions that the preliminary shaking doesn't prelude many other earthquakes, which occur along the Minto Fault.
If people remember in 2014, there was a magnitude 5 out toward Minto and some magnitude 4.5. Those were just regular earthquakes. No, nothing special happening before them.
Tape says understanding the precursor signal is valuable because the fault will most likely continue to generate similar activity in the future.
That's one thing exciting about seismology and also a little scary, is that what happened in the past will very likely happen in the future.
Tape says precursor shaking is likely particular to the Minto Fault, which has unique characteristics. Tape's research is being published this month in the journal Nature Geoscience. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Summer Special Olympic Games kick off tomorrow in Anchorage.
The athlete's oath is, let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. And that's exactly what Special Olympics does.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Voters in the Kenai Peninsula Borough will decide in October whether the small Russian Old Believer village of Kachemak Selo, also known as K-Selo, will get a new school. The roadless village near the head of Kachemak Bay serves roughly 45 students in three deteriorating houses that were converted into classrooms more than 30 years ago. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly approved putting the roughly $5.4 million bond proposition on the ballot on Tuesday. The state would pay for a majority of the school, which is estimated to cost about $15.5 million. Antonin Murachev attends high school in K-Selo, and he reminded assembly members why the village needs a new school before they voted.
You can just look in the ceiling and then you'll see the clouds and blue, whatever. We have buckets under a few other cracks, and we just have duct tape the corners that you can see the outside through, and we blocked off other gaps with just plywood and stuff like that so the rain can't get in.
Not everyone spoke in favor of approving the bond. Nikiski High School teacher Jesse Bjorkman questioned whether the school would attract new residents to the peninsula and the village.
I look forward to hearing that conversation from the community. Hopefully they can provide some reassurance to the rest of the voters in the Kenai Peninsula about what their community will look like and how the infrastructure of this school will pay its own way.
Several pushed back against Bjorkman's comments, including Assemblymember Kelly Cooper. Cooper told Bjorkman and others that because the state would fund most of the project, it also decides how large the facility would be if approved by voters. Cooper added the borough is required to provide access to education and safe facilities in remote communities such as K-Selo. Borough residents would pay for the bond via property taxes. Property owners would pay just under $5 per $100,000 of assessed value on their property. That's a point school board member Debbie Carey drove home.
Just because there's only 40 or 50 kids in the village doesn't mean that they don't deserve an education. And in order for them to get a school, this is where we need to proceed. An average home is about $200,000. On your property taxes, it's going to be about $10. But those kids deserve an education in a safe building.
The legislature approved covering 70% of the project's price tag in 2016. The state reduced that number by 5%, but it increased the maximum amount it's willing to spend on the school, increasing the borough's required 30% match. This is the borough's last chance to ask taxpayers to help fund the school. State funding for a new facility is set to expire in 2019. Borough residents will vote on the bond proposition during the regular election in October. The U.S. Forest Service won't be facilitating a controversial old-growth timber sale in the Tongass National Forest, at least not in the immediate future. The agency received zero bids on the Kuyu Island timber sale before its closing deadline on Tuesday. The Forest Service has tried to sell these trees before in 2016, but it didn't receive any offers back then either, even after all of the wood was approved for export. The agency made changes to this latest version of the sale, reducing it by half and removing some of the more sensitive watershed areas. But the sale still faces a lawsuit filed by conservation groups and a tour company over its outdated environmental analysis. One of the plaintiffs in the case says old-growth logging in the Tongass is a practice that needs to end. One of Canada's largest power companies is another step closer to acquiring electric utilities in the Pacific Northwest, including one in Juneau. The sale hinges on multiple states' regulatory authorities granting approval, and this week, Alaska became the first state to give the okay. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
The Toronto-based company Hydro One calls the decision a milestone. The company has spent the past year going through the process of trying to buy Avista, which is the parent company of the electric provider in Juneau. But Hydro One will still need to get the go-ahead from regulatory authorities in other states where the utility operates, like Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Montana. If one of those states declines, the entire sale could fall through. The Canadian acquisition of the utility has drawn some scrutiny. In Juneau, there have been concerns over the prospect of a foreign company owning the hydroelectric dam that helps power the city, which was constructed by the U.S. federal government. Right now, the state of Alaska owns it. And one of the stipulations laid out between Avista and the city and borough of Juneau is that things will essentially stay the same. A spokesperson for Hydro One says with all of the states on board, it hopes to close the transaction by the end of this year. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Fishermen in Wrangell can properly dispose of gillnets they no longer want. The environmental arm of Wrangell's local tribe is collecting and recycling this waste. KSTK's June Leffler has more.
The gillnet disposal program is in its fourth year, and 10,000 pounds was collected through the program last year. The tribe decided to step in when it realized the problem this waste was causing the city.
Because it was a problem for both public works and harbors, because nets would end up in the water or they would end up in the dumpsters, which can cause problems with the equipment.
Chris Hatton is the IGAP coordinator for the tribe. Of course, these nets cause environmental hazards as well.
When gillnets are left adrift or when they end up in the water, they end up actually catching. They ghost fish. They continue fishing. They end up on the bottom of the ocean. Seals, sea lions, other fish get trapped in them, and then other creatures go to eat the animals that are trapped, and they become entangled in them, and it becomes a giant mess of nastiness floating in the water.
Kim Wickman is also with the IGAP department. She says these nets can cause the same problem when disposed of on land, affecting porcupines, deer, and other animals. Wickman says the waste will be transported to a recycling company in Burlington, Washington. The waste can eventually be made into all kinds of things.
And they are basically going to be melting it down, and they can turn it into flooring or tiles for flooring. And then Nike has got a big push right now to, they're making shoes out of recycled gillnets. In Chile, there's a company that's turning them into skateboard decks. So there's lots of uses once the stuff's been melted down, and it's kind of neat if you get really bored and want to Google it. The skateboard decks are beautiful. And the shoes are very cute. But
Wickman says the funding for this program is expected to end in 2020. At that point, the tribe won't be able to hire folks to process and transport the material. The Indian General Assistance Program is funded by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. While IGAP funding is stable, says Hatton, the EPA has urged tribal groups to find other monies for solid waste removal programs.
We'll always be able to do, like Kim said, outreach and education, but we won't be able to have dollars spent on hands-on solid waste activities like this or our collection of e-waste, that sort of stuff, because it may go away in 2020.
The local IGAP department has hired a small crew to process the waste this summer. Fishermen can dispose gillnet filament any time of year. Now is a good time to do that, since fishing seasons are underway and coming up. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Fairbanks International Airport and Eielson Air Force Base no longer use a type of firefighting foam containing a chemical compound that has contaminated groundwater around the city and that poses a potential threat to human health. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
When Fairbanks International emergency personnel conducted their annual firefighting training exercise last week, they did not use a type of fire-suppressing foam that contains PFAS. That's the abbreviation for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, the chemical compounds that have contaminated groundwater in at least two areas around Fairbanks.
Back in November, the airport procured the newest foam that's out there, and basically the difference is it doesn't have PFOS and PFOA.
Airport spokeswoman Sammy Loud says instead of PFAS and its chemical cousin PFOA, the airport now uses a type of fire-suppressing foam that's known as FOSCHECK. That's a variant of the fire-suppressing slurry that's dropped from aircraft onto wildfires. Loud says the FOSCHECK is safer than PFAS because its molecular structure is formulated in a way that doesn't allow it to be absorbed into the environment as easily as PFAS.
It can't break down into other compounds that could be harmful.
PFAS and related chemical compounds have been linked to cancer, autoimmune disorders, and other threats to human health. Loud says that's why Fairbanks International stopped using PFAS last fall after testing showed it had infiltrated groundwater around the airport after years of use. Loud says FOSCHECK does, however, contain chemical compounds related to PFAS.
It doesn't have PFAS. PFAS and PFOA in it, but it does have other PFAS compounds that aren't regulated. But it's the safer of the options that we have at this time that we're allowed to use.
Eielson Air Force Base, where PFAS was first detected, also has discontinued use of foam containing the substance. A base spokesperson says emergency personnel there have removed foam with PFAS and PFOA from all fire response vehicles and replaced it with a high-expansion foam that does not contain PFAS or PFOA. The spokesperson said in an email that Eielson is in the process of renovating fire suppression systems in all hangars at the base to use the new type of foam. A Fort Wainwright spokesperson could not confirm Friday whether post officials have discontinued use of PFAS at Ladd Army Airfield. Samples of groundwater around Wainwright have shown the presence of PFAS, and more testing is scheduled. And post officials are working to acquire a system that will not allow fire-suppressing foam used during training to escape into the environment. Loud says officials at Fairbanks International also are considering ways to contain firefighting foam used for training.
We are researching different options for the future to have an even more secure containment system for when we foam test each year.
Loud says foam with PFAS has been used in years past at the burn pit that airport emergency personnel used for the May 30th firefighting training exercise. She says airport officials hope to have a new system in place for next year's exercise that will contain any type of foam used in training. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
About 50 people attended a presentation Wednesday by weavers and weaving historians in Juneau. One presenter, Della Cheney, is Haida and Tlingit. She stressed the importance of learning those traditions.
There's those things that I enjoy about our ways of life that are so rich and so dynamic because it's life. It's our way of life that creates these things that are with us today.
This was her second year of presenting at Celebration. Another presenter, Megan O'Brien of Alert Bay, British Columbia, first began making baskets to collect berries in 2007. O'Brien is of Haida and Irish descent. She later had several mentors who helped teach her different weaving styles, including her Raven's Tale teacher.
I felt really honored and privileged and that the knowledge was so sacred. But I don't think initially, like, my personal thing that I'm more drawn to is all the much more utilitarian. And I just really like the plain work baskets more than anything. So I just think being able to use things is really important.
The presentation was part of Celebration. The nearly week-long festival honors Southeast Alaska Native cultural knowledge and traditions. For more Celebration coverage, go to ktoo.org/celebration. Around 250 athletes from across the state will compete this weekend in five events at the Special Olympic Summer Games in Anchorage. As Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry reports, the games are about competition, but they're also about bringing together Alaska athletes and fostering independence and inclusivity.
One, two, three, four, five.
It's the last practice before the competition this weekend, and Matt Malelli is leading his basketball teammates in a series of group stretches. Malelli wears a Golden State Warriors jersey with star player Steph Curry's number 30 on the back. He and his teammates start shooting layups and move through a series of warm-up exercises. Malelli smiles and rebounds the ball with ease. He makes a difficult shot and his teammates cheer. This is his 23rd year competing in the Special Olympics. Both his parents played sports, and he started competing when he was 8 years old.
It's about meeting new friends and competing against some other people. I compete against some friends I haven't seen for a long time.
Special Olympics Alaska hosts 4 statewide events a year. Throughout the year, 11 communities also hold their own regional events. Athletes compete for a chance to head to state and later nationals.
The athlete's oath is, let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. And that's exactly what Special Olympics does, is it gives athletes, people with intellectual disabilities, to have an opportunity to play sports.
That's Jessica Bjornstad, Director of Communications and Development for Special Olympics Alaska. She says this weekend, athletes will also have an opportunity to get free dental, eye, and fitness exams through the Healthy Athletes program.
One of our core values at Special Olympics is health is our commitment. And so Healthy Athletes just ties in so nicely, where it provides an opportunity for our athletes to go through a health screening. And that's provided by different healthcare professionals across Anchorage.
Veteran athlete Aisha Abdul-Jalal trains for the Special Olympics year-round. Abdul-Jalal has been competing since 2001, when she first got involved through a school program that brought together students with and without disabilities to play sports. She competes in bowling in the fall, snowshoeing in the winter, and track and field in the summer. She says playing sports has helped her gain independence.
I'm excited about being out there, competing, beating my times in my races, and seeing all my friends from the different communities.
All events are free and open to the public. Friday night's opening ceremony includes a speech from Olympic snowboarder Rosie Mankari. Abdul-Jalal will also be reading the athlete's oath in front of a crowd of hundreds. And then, in July, both she and Mullally are headed to nationals in Seattle as part of a team of 25 Alaskan athletes and Unified Partners. Unified Partners are people without intellectual disabilities who train and compete alongside athletes.
I'm looking forward to bringing home the gold and doing my personal best.
After that, it's time to start training for the fall. In Anchorage, I'm Mary McKinstry.
And finally tonight, we have a correction to a story we aired yesterday about legislative ethics reforms. The story misstated that the 2006 ballot measure to limit legislative sessions to 90 days had no effect. The Alaska legislature ended its session within 90 days in 2009 and 2013. The story identified 2017 as the most recent year when lawmakers went past 90 days, when in fact, this year's session ended on the 118th day. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Elizabeth Jenkins and Trip Krause in Juneau, June Leffler in Wrangell, and Aaron McKinstry in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Opioids are sometimes prescribed for pain. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Never share your opioids with family, friends, or anyone at all. It may cause addiction, trouble with the law, overdose, and death. Always securely store your opioids away from children and others who may misuse them. Learn more about opioid safety at opioids.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.